Hello, and welcome to episode 140 of the Sea Control Podcast, hosted by the Center for International Maritime Security. My name is Matthew Marighi, your senior producer for Sea Control, and on this week's episode, we are joined by Admiral Charles Michel, the Vice Commandant of the United States Coast Guard, for a discussion about the Coast Guard's place in maritime security. We talk about a wide range of topics, everything from emerging threats in maritime security, the Coast Guard's unique role in cybersecurity, and the challenges they face for ensuring the integrity of America's maritime supply chains. We'll get started with this eye-opening interview after a brief word about our organization.
SIMSEC brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership. Join us today.
And we're back. As I mentioned at the top, I'm here with Admiral Michel, the Vice Commandant of the United States Coast Guard. Admiral Michel, thank you so much for being with us on Sea Control today.
Well, thanks for having me, Matt. I appreciate it.
So as is Sea Control tradition, please introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about your background, how you came to be where you are now, and what were the main events that happened to you along the way?
Sure. No, I'm the Vice Commandant of the Coast Guard, so I'm the number two person in the Coast Guard. I assist the Commandant. We're running this great organization called the United States Coast Guard, which has about 40,000 active duty members, plus a reserve, plus we have a cadre of auxiliaries who help us out, too. Really, are an agency with global responsibilities, so Commandant needs somebody like me to help him run this entire enterprise. So I'm the Chief Operating Officer. I'm also the Chief Acquisition Officer and a bunch of other things that make this the world's best Coast Guard. I think I'm kind of an interesting background here, Matt, and I know you've got a naval officer audience, but Coast Guard's kind of unique in that we can become specialized officers but also retain our line credentials at the same time. So I'm a lawyer, a staff judge advocate for the Coast Guard, as well as an operator. So I spent about half of my pre-flag officer career afloat and the other half as a lawyer, which is kind of unusual. Now I've been able to work my way all the way up in the organization. I think I'm, according to my bio, I'm the only four-star officer in all the armed forces who's also a career staff judge advocate, which is kind of an unusual thing, just a consequence of what I do in the Coast Guard. So I've got kind of a unique background between operations afloat and then legal, and I've done some other things throughout my Coast Guard career as well.
Well, let's talk for a minute about your role. So, like you mentioned, you're the only four-star JAG that's managed to make it to that level. But you're also the first four-star officer in the Coast Guard that is not the commandant.
That's correct.
In order to, I forget what the exact wording was, but to basically align the Coast Guard with the other military services.
That's correct.
So then in terms of your day-to-day role in doing acquisitions operations, how then have you sort of transitioned the role of the vice commandant to being a four-star billet? Have you noticed it being different or, you know, how has that gone?
Yeah, it's different in a good way. I think the Congress chose to elevate this position of vice commandant from what's traditionally been a three-star all the way up to four-star, in recognition of the prominence of the Coast Guard and in recognition of the need for another senior officer for all the diplomatic and representational responsibilities that he and I share. I know we kind of mentioned about COO and the acquisition officer, which are, I mean, they've got some external aspects to it, but our work with all the elements of the defense establishment, bringing a four-star to the table, gets you into different level engagements than you do as a three-star. It's the same thing on the international scene. Bringing a four-star to the table gives a bit of a different flavor. I know for our junior officers, they say, oh, what's the difference between a one and a two-star? But there's a big difference between a three-star and a four-star in a lot of events. And I think it's a reflection of the prominence of the Coast Guard and, frankly, the credibility of the Coast Guard within the congressional leadership where they decided to elevate this position.
So let's talk then about those things that you mentioned, particularly your work with the other military services. What is the Coast Guard's true role that you see in the maritime security space, in particular, how it organizes and how it works with other military services? But then also, how does the Coast Guard sort of pursue its unique mission set of being both a military service and also a law enforcement agency, which must not be an easy bridge to sort of straddle?
Yeah, I'll tell you. And for your folks, listeners who aren't familiar with the Coast Guard, we're a member of the armed forces at all time, and at the exact same time, we've got all these other responsibilities. We're a law enforcement agency, a regulatory agency, a humanitarian agency, an environmental protection agency, navigation, communication, and a whole bunch of other things we bring to the fight. But we're all that at exactly the same time. So when you're talking about the world of threats, we have an oar in the water on the sort of symmetric threats. So these would be nation-state actors. And the Coast Guard, on any given day, a number of our ships are chopped to combatant commanders. So today, without giving the numbers, we have a number of ships which are down working with U.S. Southern Command in the detection and monitoring mission, which is led by the Department of Defense. And we have a number of ships committed there. We have 6 patrol boats over in the Persian Gulf who are chopped to CENTCOM working today. Lots of times we'll have an icebreaker chopped to PACOM for the deep freeze missions. We participate in RIMPAC and a whole bunch of other exercises with the Department of Defense. So we've got responsibilities on the symmetric side of the house. And on any given day, there are Coast Guard people serving on every continent. Some of them are small boat units. Some of them are on major cutters and doing a whole bunch of things. So we're required by statute to operate as a specialized service in the Navy during time of war when the president directs. So all our equipment is interoperable with all the other DoD partners. Many of our aspects of operations are woven together. At the same time, the Coast Guard has the daily job of being a law enforcement agency, a regulatory agency, and quite a number of other things that we do. And a lot of our effort is engaged in that. So regulation of the shipping industry, making sure that cargo entering the nation's ports is secure, making sure that this great inland waterway system, which is a whole highway that's necessary for this economy to operate, all works together. We deal with all the navigation up on the Great Lakes. We conduct polar operations. We protect the nation's fisheries. You probably see us on the Weather Channel on rescuing people in storms and all the other type of things. So it's really a unique agency, and it operates against the whole threat spectrum, all the way from symmetric actors like you talked about before, to terrorists, to criminals, to regulatory violators, to mom-and-pop boaters getting into trouble, to threats from natural disasters, whether they be hurricanes, earthquakes, oil spills, everything. We do all that stuff with about 40,000 people, smaller than the size of the New York City Police Department.
So that's obviously a lot to tackle with 40,000 people and a very broad mission set, and one that I think many of our listeners know some of the aspects of but don't really know all of them. So as you, from your position as the Vice Commandant, look at those different challenges in maritime security and to the missions the Coast Guard is prosecuting, which of those threats are the ones that sort of interest you the most, that you think are going to be the most potent, or the ones that have the potential to evolve to be the most pressing for our national security? Is it transnational criminal elements, illegal migration? What are sort of the things that you're keeping an eye on?
Yeah, boy, man, there are so many threats facing. I appreciate your question. I'm just trying to get my arms around it.
There's a lot of challenges.
On the symmetric side of the house, and I'll leave North Korea and some of those actors, but take a look at some of the challenges in freedom of navigation that are being asserted by nation states right now, whether it's Russian navigation restrictions up in the Northern Sea Route or things that are going on in the South China Sea. That increasing world of many of these are unlawful navigation restrictions. That concerns me as a Coast Guardsman quite a bit, because I think freedom of the seas, both for national security purposes, movement of commerce, have been absolutely critical to this nation. The Coast Guard plays a key role in all those different freedom of navigation assertions, whether it's being the lead element at the International Maritime Organization over in London, where we continue to champion these rights, or our operations downrange. So those concern me a lot on restrictions on navigation on kind of the symmetric side of the house. On more of the asymmetric side of the house, got a lot of terrorists out there doing a lot of bad things. Some of them have shown ability to operate in the maritime spaces. We get concerned about that. The maritime is also a logical route for terrorists to use to move either goods or terrorists themselves all around the world. We monitor that extremely carefully. Post September 11th, we basically have established a layered security regime that reaches all the way overseas, involves the ports, the ships themselves, and a whole network of connections as we try to deal with those asymmetric threats that may harm this nation. And then we have a whole bunch of other challenges about competition for resources, whether it's unlawful claims to hydrocarbon jurisdiction or fisheries poaching or a whole bunch of other things. There's kind of a whole world of work there that impacts us and our neighbors. I get concerned about the transnational criminal organizations that are here in the Western Hemisphere of increasing sophistication. I mean, these are individuals who can put out semi-submersible vessels with over 3,000-mile range. That means they can carry 7 to 10 metric tons of any product you want from South America to Africa, for example, almost undetected. The level of sophistication of those actors, their ability to impact the lives of people here in the Western Hemisphere, where they're creating huge homicide rates, instability, which is driving migration trends, which is driving instability at the southwest border. That whole problem set I worry about quite a bit. And then we've got all our other things that I worry about of, you know, when's the next black swan event that comes along, like a Deepwater Horizon oil spill or a major hurricane or a New Madrid fault, major earthquake, of which we've got responsibilities for. We try to plan for all those things. It really is a world of threats. And I will tell you that it requires very agile agencies to have the capabilities, capacities, and authorities to be able to deal with this entire range of threats. You know, whether they're symmetric nation state threats, law enforcement challenges, terrorists, and others. And then the big one in my wheelhouse, the one that surprises me the most every single day, is in the world of cybersecurity. And you wouldn't think the Coast Guard be that involved in cyber, but we actually are, and in a couple different aspects. One is we are a member of the Department of Defense Information Network, so we've got our own cyber defense challenges. We've also got our arms around how we use cyber to better enable our mission sets. And then lastly, we're the agency charged with the regulatory responsibility for an increasingly automated shipping and port industry. And you may have seen that we just had a major attack on Maersk shipping lines and Maersk ports, which shut them down for a while and adjust in time delivery chain. And they were subjected to a cyber attack, and that concerns us greatly because that industry is a model of efficiency. And large reason that it's a model of efficiency is because it relies on the Internet of Things and networked IT and all the goodness that comes with that. But every time you bring a new navigation, communication, engine monitoring system, something that replaces a human, and you plug that into networked IT, it creates vulnerabilities as well. So that's probably my most dynamic world of work, because I'm trying to build a real workforce and capability to be able to operate in that space while that space is really kind of an active operational battle space is what I'll call it.
Well, let's dive deeper into the cyber issue, because I confess when I was doing some research before coming in here, I saw some of the talks that you gave on cyber, and it surprised me, you know, just as much as it did you, about how crucial that realm and that domain is to the Coast Guard's operations. So let's dive into it a little bit more. Walk us through a little bit about what happened. The attack on Maersk was Petya, right?
It was a Petya variant virus, yes.
So walk us through then what happened, not just the basics of what happened, but how the Coast Guard got involved. What were the things that you personally learned about how the Coast Guard needs to prepare for attacks like that in the future? And what are the things that you're doing about that to get in front of those next challenges?
Boy, Matt, there's so much to your question right there. First of all, I came out on a radar screen. We've got a good partner in Maersk. We do have authority to actually mandate reporting under certain circumstances from certain partners. I can't remember whether this was a mandatory one. It doesn't matter. They were a responsible party. They brought that to our attention that this was impacting their operations. A lot of Maersk actually sits on our Maritime Security Committees, which, if you're not aware, the Coast Guard captain of the port for each one of the nation's 361 major ports. That captain of the port is by statute designated as a federal maritime security coordinator. He actually chairs what's called an Area Maritime Security Committee. That brings together all the federal, state, local, tribal, and private interests together at the table to deal with maritime security, because ports are really integrated. And if you have a part of the port that's impacted, it typically will impact other parts of the port. So getting a holistic approach to this problem set is critical, and those AMSCs perform that function. So this report was brought in through the AMSCs. We took a look at it from a security perspective, in touch with Maersk. Now, the reality of it is a lot of these systems, I mean, just the one that was impacted here, this is not a government-owned system. This is a privately owned system. And the Coast Guard has in place right now on the physical security side of the house, we actually have mandatory regulations regarding things like access controls and things like that. On the cyber side of the house, we have some voluntary guidance that's out there right now, but we have not yet imposed performance standards for cybersecurity for certain type of regulated either shipping or port facilities. So we're operating against that type of a legal backdrop. But we reached out to assist Maersk to the extent that we could to try to get their arms around what type of attack they were under and what type of systems were being impacted, whether these were business systems or industrial control systems and a whole bunch of other things. Without going into great detail, a large portion of their remediation took place by their business people. I mean, these were their business systems by and large that were operated. But that split, when you think about it, Matt, that split between what is the responsibility for defense of the nation from cyber attack is a really, really complicated problem. I'll give you an example. So on Maersk, for a Maersk port facility, they have certain performance standards for access controls, and we require them to put those in place. And typically those access controls are to keep out, you know, someone who might want to trespass on the property, or maybe a terrorist or a criminal or something like that. But it's not typically not to keep nation states out. If a nation state wanted access to that port facility, we don't require them to build to hold off nation states. But think about this from a cyber perspective. That exact same security posture for that Maersk port facility, if a nation state actually attacks their cyber infrastructure, who's got responsibility for deterring that cyber attack? Does that fall on that individual citizen, or does that fall on the government, or is it an insurance problem, I mean, or a regulatory problem? Or, I mean, there's a bunch of ways you can skin that cat, but we're going to have to get our arms around this, that in the physical security side of the house, we've got that pretty much wired. We know what territoriality is. We know what a nation-state attack is. We know what the international law boundaries on that. It has a physicality aspect that we're comfortable with, you know, where you can draw borders on maps and things like that. Cyber's a different animal. Every time you turn on your cell phone, I'm pointing at your cell phone here on the table. Every time you turn that sucker on, it's not just your friends and family. It's also hacktivists, criminals, nation states, all types of different actors. And what is your level of responsibility for the security of that system? How we get our arms around that is it's much broader. That's a much broader problem set than the Coast Guard. But as a lawyer, I can tell you one of the things that I think will make a difference is if we can come up with a common vocabulary and start defining some of the terms in this space, and we can develop the norms that we did in the physical world, you know, those international norms that we did in the physical world, and get those into a cyber regime, I think that will help a lot in trying to sort out this universe. But we're building this plane as it's flying. Understand this. This is real operations occurring in this space. Good operations and bad operations that are occurring in this space. We've got to get our arms around that. Coast Guard's kind of unique in this, and I think we talk from a position of not a large organization, but authority rich. And when the Coast Guard was created, we were created not only to be able to deal with symmetric threats, i.e. nation states, and the Coast Guard's been in every single war or conflict of the United States since the founding of the country, that's had a maritime component, so we deal with that symmetric. But we've also got this basket of other authorities that deal with law enforcement challenges and regulatory challenges and insurance challenges and all these other things that we've got to be able to deal with. And you're going to want to convert that same type of a flexible, nimble organization to cyber. Because when you get a cyber attack, where is it coming from? In the past, if we knew it was from a nation state, you'd know what the authorities were. If it was for a criminal, you'd know what the authorities are. Now, many times you get ambiguous threats. So when you align your authorities and responsibilities against those ambiguous threats, you want to have nimble agencies like the Coast Guard, or maybe the National Guard's another one who's got a very nimble, authority-rich regime to be able to deal with these type of threats. So I know Alexander Hamilton founded the Coast Guard in 1790, but in many ways he was cyber-aware because he created a very nimble organization with all these authorities to deal with the whole regime of threats.
A parallel challenge to that, or I guess a similar challenge that you sort of alluded to in the cyber domain, which is the Coast Guard's role in protecting the supply chains and the logistics infrastructure.
Right.
So there's the cyber dimension, but there also are similar challenges in the public-private ownership aspects for physical assets too.
Right.
So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what the Coast Guard's role is now and then will be in the future for ensuring the supply chain security of the United States.
Yeah, it's related to what I said before. So we built this wondrous supply chain. I mean, it's the marvel of the world, and it gets better every single day of just-in-time delivery of products, all overseen by this amazing network of integrated IT that makes all this stuff happen, where you can monitor that container from the time it's loaded, where it gets on, where it's transshipped, all the way here, delivers here. It's sequenced and racked and stacked to get on that automated truck that carries it to the rail yard or wherever it's headed on to all this next thing. And the Coast Guard does not own that supply chain, the entirety of the supply chain. We basically own the part from where it's loaded and then where it gets off. And we've got responsibilities for a certain amount of actually reaching into the port, which was critical. It was actually one of when you look at the negotiation of the International Shipping Port Facility Security Code at the IMO, it was revolutionary for the IMO actually to reach off to the ship and onto the pier. It was a major, major step forward, but frankly, I think the right thing to do to bring that port infrastructure into the security realm. And our domestic legislation does essentially that same thing. But there are other agencies like CBP, Customs and Border Protection, with their lading rules and manifesting, electronic manifesting, cargo tracking, container security initiative, CTPAT. It's basically a partnership against terrorism that's voluntary, where shippers can become essentially trusted shippers. So it's a combination of things that are going to protect this security chain. A lot of it resides on the shippers themselves. But part of it is governmental too, making sure we know what goes in those particular containers, where they're laden on ships, what's the security arrangement at the port, what's the security arrangement on the ship, what security arrangement at the port on the other end, how does it get on the intermodal transport and ultimately reaches on to its destination, all of which has a cyber element because all of which resides on network IT. So it's a combination of both physical and cybersecurity. And taking a look at that, you know, I deal with these issues of, should 100% of containers be like physically opened? I think anybody who asks me that question has never been to the port of LALB when they see the amount of trade. And the vast majority of that brings goodness. Not only that, but actually essential economic strength to this country, the ability to move goods around efficiently. And what I will say is that using risk reduction techniques and increased awareness of those cargoes, you can actually smartly take care of problems in that particular set without going down to the basic guerrilla work of manually opening containers. Now, you may have to do that on occasion, but you can buy down a lot. You can actually smartly address risk in that system through some more sophisticated methods in order to be able to do that. And we're a part of that as well.
One of the most unique things about the Coast Guard that I'm seeing also in your answers to these questions is that you're frequently referencing actions that are done by private industry and by international partners that are
Absolutely.
Done seamlessly in conjunction with
Right.
your own work.
Yep.
So I'm curious, what does the Coast Guard do effectively in your mind that makes it, you know, able to operationalize these public-private partnerships and these international partnerships? Is there an approach? Is it the fact that you are a part of the IMO, which I'd love to get a chance to talk to you about more? Like, what makes the Coast Guard special at dealing with those, and what makes you guys so good?
Well, here's what I'll tell you about the Coast Guard. There's a couple things about the Coast Guard. First of all, the Coast Guard, from its design at the very beginning, was actually designed to operate with others as part of the national architecture. It started out as a kind of anti-smuggling organization. But even there, that was reaching against people who operated on the shore. It was reaching against with international partners, so on and so forth. So we have a great organizational reputation of being able to work together. And I will say that each one of our Coast Guard folks here has, as part of their organizational DNA, a natural bent to working with partners. And we're not afraid of working with partners. Many times we want to leverage partners. I think it comes to the fact that the Coast Guard is a pretty small organization with a lot of responsibilities. Authority rich, great people, but not a lot of Coast Guard to go around. So when you go into a port infrastructure, many times there is no other choice if you want to provide collective security than to go in there and work with partners. And we're not afraid to get our hands in that at all. As a matter of fact, rarely do we reach for a fully organic Coast Guard solution, which I think is almost maybe not unique in government. I think it's rare in government. Most government, when it's confronted with a problem, they say, okay, how do we build something? How much money is it going to take? What uniforms are we going to choose for these people? I mean, that's kind of what the natural bent is. The Coast Guard's first natural bent is, hey, who can we work with in order to actually get this stuff done? And we're more than comfortable working with people. We have Coast Guard people in very small numbers scattered throughout the government, scattered throughout the earth, and they bring that organizational DNA of connecting with others. They bring that basket of authorities, and they bring that organizational reputation as being an honest broker and a good partner and a partner that you want to be able to work with. And private industry loves it many, many times, because I'll tell you, many times private industry does not want a command and control government regulatory solution, the government just coming down and telling you what to do. They want assistance, and they want a level playing field so that they can remain competitive with people. Many times they want to shoulder that responsibility themselves. And that's why I'm saying cybersecurity is an example of that. I think large portions of that solution are going to come from private industry itself with government guidance to make sure that there's a level playing field. And I think that that type of softer approach is the way that the Coast Guard approaches problems. And that's the way we've been from the very beginning. We're a natural integrator. And typically our first grab is not to build our own organic solution. Matter of fact, lots of times we'll only build an organic solution if it's kind of forced to do that, because we have to do that because for some reason the market or the government's not responsive in order to do that. And we have a great reputation. I think that's why we were chosen to lead things at the IMO, which is unusual for a regulatory agency to have the actual lead for the USG at the IMO, which has essentially every country on earth, that entire international shipping piece. And we've led that actually for many, many years to great effect.
So one of the challenges that I've seen personally, that even Admiral Stavridis, the Dean of the Fletcher School, has talked about, and that the Stimson Center has been doing some emerging work on, is the role of illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing, IUU fishing, and how it can be both an economic security threat and a national security threat.
Both.
So walk us through a little bit about what you see the future of IUU fishing looking like and what the Coast Guard's role is going to be dealing with that down the road.
Yeah, first of all, from a threat perspective, I think you hit the nail on the head there. For many, many people, protein from the ocean, that's their main source of food. And I can tell you, when people can't eat, something bad's going to happen. It really is a national security threat. I can tell you, for some countries, it may be existential. A lot of the small Pacific Island nations, things like that, rely on a healthy fishery stock for a large portion of their sustenance, as well as their budget and things like that. So this is a huge challenge. And I can tell you that there is a great competition for resources. Fisheries is just one aspect for it. And the fishing technology has evolved so far, so fast right now, that boats can go in and get every bit of protein they can possibly get out of that, and then get the hell out of Dodge and go sell their product with no eye whatsoever on sustainable fisheries. It really is a tragedy of the commons. But part of the reason they can do that is because we do not have good maritime domain awareness. We, you know, anybody thinks there's an eye in the sky that sees everything happening on the oceans. We aren't there yet. I'd like to see us there at some point in the future, but we're not there yet. So it's a maritime domain awareness challenge. Governance challenge, too. The legal regimes here have been, and they have been put in place. As a matter of fact, Congress just took some action regarding IUU fishing and stuff, but it's a difficult challenge. One of the unique aspects of IUU fishing, I think, that makes it particularly difficult to deal with is that you have to have a viable at-sea enforcement regime. You just cannot deal with this through port enforcement regimes. So some fisher goes out there, he gets to choose where he wants to land that catch, or he can transship it to some other buyer out at sea or whatever, and stuff like that. By the time it gets to a port official, it's been so clouded up, you'll have no idea, and you really can't get, I'm not saying port enforcement regimes don't have their place, but if you don't really have an active at-sea enforcement presence, the ability to get those guys and catch them in the act, take their boat, take their catch, find them, you're just not going to get there. But there's not enough law enforcement assets around the world to just randomly go out and get these people. So it's a maritime domain awareness challenge. And I think that's where you're going to see some of the most innovative things done in the world of IUU fishing are going to be done in the world of maritime domain awareness. So the use of commercial overhead is one of the things that we've talked about before, with some sophisticated sensors to cue law enforcement regarding closed areas and things like that. I think that providing countries with some ability, even if it's a shared ability, to do at-sea law enforcement. So a bunch of partners will get together and share an asset, maybe use a shipwrighter program, for example, which we've done before, to spread their authorities across there. I think that, in combination with a really smart look at the battle space itself so you can identify those fishers, I think is going to be a major way forward. I also think that the world of transponders offers a lot of work. So you've got the ability to use transponders to both sort out legitimate fishers from illegitimate fishers, the ability to deal with dark vessels, you know, non-emitters, which we get better and better at that each day. And the technology gets better and cheaper and more available to a whole bunch of different people. But to deal with those dark vessels is going to be something else that we can do. But I'm kind of two minds on this thing. I really don't like the fact that there are countries out there where a lot of their fishers are doing illegal activities, and I'm not convinced that all of them are doing everything that they can to police their own fishing fleets. I wish that they would. At the same time, I'm optimistic regarding employment as technology, more sophisticated law enforcement regimes that may balance this. And I do think there's a place for port enforcement as well, although, like I said, I'm a little bit sanguine on that, is that if you don't have a viable at-sea enforcement regime, you really can't deal with that. So we'll have to keep our eye on the spot here, though.
So since we're reaching the end of our interview, we'll conclude with the same conclusion we have for most of them. Tell us a little bit about what you're reading recently. What are the main articles and books that have caught your eye?
Yeah, so, I mean, this is going to sound pretty boring, but I've actually been reading a lot of energy-related publications because I believe that the world is undergoing a geostrategic shift in the balance of power in energy and energy-related products. Although it wasn't covered very well in the press, I'm not exactly sure why. President Trump had a recent speech where he mentioned not only energy independence for this nation, but energy dominance was what he used. And it doesn't sound like maybe I'm looking at my colleagues around the table. Everybody actually saw that, but I would encourage people. That is super important. This country has been, to varying degrees, energy dependent on a whole bunch of different players in the past that it may not be in the future. They've got liquefied natural gases leaving this country in export quantities, both through the expanded Panama Canal to Asian nations, which are consuming that. President Trump, in his speech to Poland, highlighted the fact that a cargo of U.S. liquefied natural gas was delivered to Poland for the first time, which has huge geopolitical significance regarding Russia. This country, because of two simple technologies that have been brought together, horizontal drilling and fracking, has the potential of becoming a major, major energy supplier. And that's going to impact the world geopolitical balance for countries in the Middle East, for countries in South America who've relied on their kind of own version of energy dominance. I see that being chipped away. And as a Coast Guardsman, this is hugely relevant because if energy is being exported from the United States of America, unless it's going to Canada or Mexico, it's going by water, and it's going by a very sophisticated shipping industry that moves products around in a global market. Once again, kind of a just-in-time market. And we get movement of energy products around this country, down the river system, offshore, Arctic, you name it. These energy trends have the potential of reshaping the geopolitical globe that I grew up with. And I'm watching it. I'm watching it very carefully. And the Coast Guard is right in the middle of that because almost all these products, unless they're going by pipeline, which they do in some areas, but a lot of these products move by water. And when you're talking about products being moved by water, the United States Coast Guard is right in the middle of all that stuff.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for your time, Admiral Michel, and best of luck with all of those diverse security challenges you have to deal with. And we're all rooting for you.
Great. Proud to serve. Semper Paratus.
That concludes episode 140 of the Sea Control Podcast from the Center for International Maritime Security. My name is Matt Marighi, your senior producer for Sea Control. Special thanks to our guest this week, Admiral Michel, and our producer, Ryan Yulia. If you enjoyed this podcast and you haven't already yet subscribed to Sea Control, please do. Subscribing gives you automatic access to all of our episodes as they become available. And if you really like us, go on over to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating, and tell all of your friends to tune in. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time on Sea Control.